Hi, everybody. Welcome along to another episode of the Dispatches Podcast. My name is Brendan Malone. It is great to be back with you again. And today's topic of conversation, should we ban social media for children under the age of 16? Hi, my name is Brendan Malone and you're listening to The Dispatches, the podcast that strives to cut through all the noise in order to challenge the popular narratives of the day with some good old-fashioned contrarian thinking. You might not always agree, but at least you'll be taking a deeper look at the world around you. Before we go any further, a huge thank you to all of our patrons. It's thanks to you that this episode is made possible. If you're enjoying this content and you want to support our work and get exclusive subscriber-only content as well, please go to patreon.com/leftfootmedia and become a $5 monthly patron, or you can do that via the Dispatches Substack, and I'll post the link for that in today's show notes as well. Alrighty, so should we ban social media for children under the age of 16 years? For those who are living outside of New Zealand and who are not sure what I'm talking about, National MP, that's the party that's currently in government here in New Zealand, Catherine Webb, has put a private members bill into what is colloquially known as the biscuit tin in Parliament, and it could well be drawn and then voted upon. And her private members bill, if it is drawn and voted upon, it is seeking to make it illegal for children under the age of 16 years to be able to access social media, so they won't be able to set up an account. Now, this is something that is modelled on similar overseas ventures. Probably the most notable and relevant to us here in New Zealand is that last year, Australia's Senate passed laws to ban young people who are under 16 years of age from accessing social media sites by the end of this year. So they've sort of given it a bit of a grandfather type clause, allowed those companies a bit of time and a bit of grace to actually put what they need to in place. But by the end of this year, under 16 year olds, they cannot access social media, including Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, and Snapchat. But they have, and I think rather wisely, excluded YouTube from that. Now, David Seymour, who's part of the coalition here in New Zealand, he's part of the ruling coalition government right now, he has blocked the coalition from actually formally supporting the bill, which for me is another red mark in the column of David Seymour and why I don't consider him a particularly good leader for this country. Meanwhile, Winston Peters, who is on the other side of the coalition government, actually wants more investigation done and he wants to work towards a government bill. And he's actually on the record as saying, quote unquote, it's got all the hallmarks of being very necessary. Chris Hipkins, who's the Labour Party leader, the opposition party, is supportive of a ban. And Chloe Swarbrick recently told the media that, quote unquote, evidence-based knowledge and consulting a broad spectrum would be vital to avoid any overly simplistic knee-jerk reaction to moral panic. What's interesting to me in this is I like to read between the lines whenever politicians speak. And one thing I think it's important to recognise about the Green Party response to this is that they will absolutely be well aware of the fact that they are relying predominantly on a younger voter base who tend to be a little bit more naive when they vote for the Greens. And then as they age, they tend to age out of that particular party and that particular movement. And of course, that younger voter base is going to be on social media. And the Greens have traditionally used social media very effectively to their advantage. So I'm sure that's something that will be playing into all of this. But I find it fascinating that she refers to the very serious crisis that we are experiencing as a result of widespread social media use, particularly amongst our young people, as being a moral panic. That's really the farthest from what it actually is. It is a very serious issue. It has been well researched and well studied. There's no doubting that we do have a problem here. Now, in some reporting that was recently published by Radio New Zealand, we read the following. Some coaches and teachers have told Radio New Zealand that social media exposure was now a necessary part of teenagers' development for modern life. Can I humbly suggest that in actual fact, this statement is confusing normative with necessary? Just because something has been normalised, that doesn't actually make it necessary. You don't need social media to live a full and flourishing life just because it has become a normalised part of life for many people. That's not really the question you need to be exploring. Is this normal? Is this widespread? The question we need to be exploring is it actually good? Is it something that is contributing to or diminishing our human flourishing? And that's the really important question. They go on to say this: viewing motivational and inspiring stories and ideas on social media was beneficial to young people, while social media was also now a key method for communication and organising with teenagers, as well as with parents via their children. Well, first of all, if we follow the Australian model, and I think that seems to be what's being discussed at the moment, remember this is still in its very, very early infancy stages. It's still an idea. It's not something that the government has actually picked up and fully committed themselves to, but clearly there is a lot of interest and support for this particular bill. But if they follow the Australian model, then YouTube would still be available. So young people could still watch inspiring stories on that particular platform. Also, you don't actually need social media for that purpose. We have this technology. It's been around for a while now. Some of you might be familiar with it. It's called books. And books are wonderful things, and they are full of inspiring stories. If you don't want to go that far back, you could, of course, rely on websites. Websites will still be available. They're not social media, and they can still host inspiring content for people to watch. And of course, communication doesn't actually require social media. So for example, WhatsApp is not classified as social media. And I think this is important to understand, because some people are using the term social media, in my humble opinion, in a far too blanket kind of way. They are using it to describe anything and everything that is like a modern communications technology that you might find on a phone or a computer. That's not really what is being talked about here, and I don't think that's really an adequate definition of social media. The focus is on those particular platforms which have an algorithm, which are scrolling driven, which are platforms that you really are driven by, and are platforms whereby you have a mechanism of refreshing which creates a dopamine loop in the brain and all sorts of things like that, rather than WhatsApp or text messages or platforms and technologies that can actually be used for people to communicate with each other. So you could still do all the things they've said there and prohibit social media for under 16s. So I guess the key question then is, how strong is the case against social media? Is this bill really necessary? Or is it more like what Chloe Swarbrick is hinting at, that this is some sort of moral panic? And as someone who regularly speaks, in fact, I'll be speaking to a group of parents up in Auckland in a few days' time about this very issue. And this is something that I have been over now for quite a number of years, and have been aware of the technology, aware of what the research is showing us, aware of what the various benefits and also the risks and harms are. And I can say resoundingly, in response to the question, how strong is the case against social media? Is this bill necessary? I can resoundingly and strongly say, yes, it absolutely is. Let me list some of the harms that we're talking about here. On the one hand, social media allows young people to communicate very quickly with each other, but it also means that predators can now have very easy access to children and young people. And often that access can be unfiltered and parents have no awareness of what's going on. It's also been pivotal in the widespread and speedy spread of falsehood and lies. Already, even in the last few days since the election of Pope Leo XIV, there have already been a slew of completely false memes and quotes and even fake AI videos that have been produced claiming to be Pope Leo XIV or from him or statements he's made, and they're absolutely not true, and they have spread like wildfire. And that is primarily amongst adults, as far as I can see. So it's something to be very aware of with this particular technology. I think it was Winston Churchill who once said that a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth even has a chance to put its pants on. Now, if that's misinformation, I apologise. I could be remembering the source of that incorrectly, but that quote, I think, is still valid here. It has become now a fundamental tool of bullying, and a new type of bullying that is far more pernicious and, in fact, deadly than the previous kinds of bullying that people like I experienced when I was in school and a lot younger, and this technology didn't exist. Now, bullying has always been a thing. One person or a group of people trying to exert dominance or scapegoat another person or group, that's not unusual. But this technology changes the game in some major ways. First of all, the bully actually now follows you home. The bully can be with you potentially 24/7. That was not normal previously. So this is a brand new problem and something that this technology directly enables and facilitates. And of course, there's also the fact that when people get online, and I'll explain why in just a second, they go further and they act in ways that are much worse than they would as if they were seeing someone face to face. Why is that? Well, this is because of something known as the online disinhibition effect. What happens is, as the name suggests, people get online and their inhibitions go out the window. They forget that they are actually talking with people or talking to or about people, and all they see on the screen is pixels, and so their brain doesn't actually kick into gear like it normally should. When you see someone's face or hear their voice or with them, you know, you're with them in the room and you are there enjoying their presence and their company, good or bad, there tends to be something in your brain that happens that's really good. Your empathy mechanisms kick in. But when you simply see pixels on a screen, you're not actually with the person, you tend to fail to recognize that you're actually speaking to or about a person, and you tend to go much further. You also tend to think that it's just you and this device. You forget that everyone potentially in the world could be watching what you are saying and doing. And also on a lot of social media platforms, what happens is you get rewarded for being quite rude and crass and obscene and hurtful to other people. The dopamine kicks that you get off interaction from your posts, those posts that generate more interaction on a lot of these platforms generally tend to be the more negative posts. And so you get a kick out of it, basically. You're getting a dopamine hit in your brain, the pleasure chemical, from doing this kind of thing, and you are rewarded effectively for engaging in behaviors the exact opposite of what we would normally reward people for offline. So offline, we would reward people and congratulate them and praise them for being humble, for being gentle, for being loving. That's not what you get rewarded for on social media. And so particularly with young people, it tends to foster all sorts of issues, and in particular when it comes to bullying. There is also amplified social comparison effect, and this is where people compare themselves to others. This has always been with us. The old looking over the fence and thinking that what your neighbor has is better than what you have and comparing your life negatively to what they have. But on social media, this is even more of a problem, because on social media, we tend to show the best and hide the rest. We don't show the full truth of our life. And what happens is that the more time we spend scrolling through a social media platform where we can see posts and photographs and videos and all sorts of things from other people, what we start doing, even subconsciously, is comparing our life to what we see. This carefully curated and carefully manufactured list of show the best and hide the rest. Wrong way around, wasn't it? And we unfortunately think that this is normal. It's not normal. And the research indicates the more time you spend on social media, the more anxiety and depression you start to feel about your own life. And this is one of the reasons why. Social media is also absolutely responsible for spreading social contagions in a very, very effective way. For example, the trans identity confusion that we have been plagued by in recent years, it's a very new and sudden phenomenon that absolutely meets all the criteria for a social contagion, something that has just suddenly come out of nowhere and people have caught it like they would a virus. Well, in this case, social media was the pivotal viral vector. It was the very mechanism that allowed that social contagion to spread. If there wasn't social media, this social contagion, it is almost like 99.9% certain that this would not have actually been as successful at transmitting itself throughout society as it has been. It has also been shown to create harms for learning outcomes. And there's lots of ways this can happen, not just spending too much time on a device trying to learn that way or outsourcing your memory to Google, but also young people who spend too much time on social media, they often experience tiredness, there tends to be distraction. Even if you have the phone in the room with you at night, even if the phone itself is turned onto silent, every time that light kicks up, you are pulled out of your deep sleep by the lighting up of the phone, even in a room. So there's lots of ways this can hinder learning outcomes. It is also obviously a porn superhighway, and I think in many ways that would be an understatement. The ability to access, and again, unfiltered, very easy and absolutely uncontrolled access to pornography. It is, as I said, well, it's a superhighway. I think that's the best way to describe it. Not only that, but it has become a bit of an OnlyFans feeder now, the pornography, amateur pornography website, where people sell themselves on this website to make money. And for a couple of years now, experts have been talking about the Instagram to OnlyFans pipeline. And what they mean by that is that social media like Instagram, which is not a pornography site, is actually driving people into and putting them on a very speedy pathway towards becoming OnlyFans users, people who actually sell themselves in some way on OnlyFans to make money. And it absolutely makes sense when you stop and think about it, because what you've got is a whole group of particularly young women who are harmed by this particular phenomena. They are socialized in a way to think that it is normal to put themselves out there in this way, to not have tact or boundaries or anything like that, and to also be rewarded for putting yourself out there. And with something like Instagram, if you show a bit more flesh, then you will get the benefits of that. And so it becomes a very easy pathway into OnlyFans. You have a whole group of people who have been socialized to create these sort of artificial personas and put them out there for the whole world to see and be rewarded for doing that. And so it's not much of a jump then to say, hey, well, why don't you actually make money? Because there's lots of money potentially to be made here if you take the next step and start producing pornography on OnlyFans and be rewarded for doing that. It's now also a serious form of behavioral addiction. This is obviously dopamine driven. The more time you spend on social media and engaging with posts, and when you post, you get likes, you get shares, you have people responding, all of those things give you a little dopamine hit. It's the pleasure chemical in the brain. It's not the whole story, but it is a factor in behavioral addiction and rewiring neural pathways. We often think about this in relation to pornography, but we forget that in actual fact, social media can have the exact same effect on the brain. And the other thing that we know now, the best available research tells us, is that under the age of 16, children's brains are not really developed enough to be ready for social media and all of the other challenges and complications that go along with social media. So 16 is not really an arbitrary proposition. It is something that is grounded in what we have as the best available research in front of us right now. Now, is this government overreach? Because some people have been suggesting that that's what this could be. In response, I would say no. Now, it could turn into that if a government wanted to overreach, but I would suggest to you that simply banning social media for under 16s is absolutely not, in and of itself, government overreach. Like, I think it's important to understand this, that the liberal position tends to be, particularly the more libertarian position of liberalism, is to tend to want to say that you should just be able to do whatever you want to, and everyone is just an individual. And even if you've got a family with young kids, you're just an individual who's chosen that pathway and you have to bear the responsibility for that. The community and the communal aspect of human society is left by the by, and it's up to you to basically police your own children. And even if you're in a situation where the government and policy and legislation and society is structured in such a way as it's actually hindering your ability to do your job well as a parent, that is a secondary factor, a secondary concern, as opposed to the liberal idea of we must actually protect and allow you to do whatever you want to because you're an autonomous self-choosing individual. Now, the conservative position would say, well, hold on a minute, that's not how a flourishing human society works. That's a recipe for disaster. So no, it's not government overreach when we have laws that are actually intended to nurture and support the common good and enable human flourishing more easily. Basically, the status quo as it is right now assumes that all or most parents have the time, the ability, and the necessary knowledge to discern and manage their children's social media usage. And I can tell you for a fact that that isn't the case. I wish it was that easy because that would make things a whole lot simpler for everybody. But in actual fact, it's not. And I'm someone, as I said, who was all over this issue and is regularly doing his best to try and keep up with the latest books and research and other things on this particular topic. And even I have to often do some really heavy lifting just to ascertain where things are at. So imagine your average parent who actually is dedicating themselves to the job of parenting and holding down a 9-to-5 job, and they don't have the privilege of being able to spend lots of time figuring this all out and also understanding exactly how the technology is changing constantly. How are they actually meant to be able to effectively help their children in this space? So what's really needed here is the government using its power to give advantage to parents. And parents should absolutely be advantaged. Corporations should not have the upper hand over parents. The status quo gives corporations, because that's what we're talking about, massive corporations, these social media companies, they now have the upper hand over parents. An under 16-year-old ban will give the power back to the parents, because what will happen is the corporations will actually have to bow to the laws of the nation, and they will actually have to require that those who sign up are 16 years of age, and that straight away is a huge benefit to empowering parents to be able to parent well. Now, some people have expressed concerns about the whole idea of providing ID and data harvesting and, you know, will they use this for nefarious purposes? Well, you know, a government is a government, and that's the possibility in the current modern age, particularly where we have abandoned Christianity. Don't be surprised to discover that your governments quite like the power and the authoritarianism that they can wield without any sort of sacred moral transcendent restraint like the moral vision of Christianity gives to people, and they might be tempted to use it for nefarious purposes. So you can never say never, but the simple fact is this, that what will be asked of people is they'll have to provide some form of ID or possibly even a credit card to actually prove that they are of age. And I think this is really important to understand. Your social media, your online presence, even just the basic use of Google, is already a very tracked thing. A lot of data is being collected from you on a daily basis just for regular interactions that you might not even consider, like, for example, using Google. And a lot of people just seem to be very oblivious of this fact. They think that just because they're not being asked for data or personal information, that data and personal information is not being tracked and utilized by these massive corporations already. So they already have a slew of data on and about you that is being tracked and is being used and is being unsold and manipulated for all sorts of reasons, unless you are someone who's gone absolutely out of your way to try and darken your internet footprint, or you've got off the internet altogether. Then the simple reality is that you are being tracked already. So this is not like suddenly we've gone from no tracking to tracking. In actual fact, it's very minimal in contrast with what's already happening. And as I said, if they require simply a credit card as proof of ID, if you've actually purchased anything online at any point, that's a transaction, that's an action that you've already engaged in. You have handed over your credit card details. But all they're going to ask for really is age verification, and these corporations will be required, as I said, to empower and support parents in their role by doing what is actually in the best interests of children. This is what we call subsidium in action. Subsidium is the principle that higher authorities should use their power for the benefit of lower authorities. So those higher authorities should never interfere with the legitimate authority of parents. That's what we call subsidiarity. So they should respect your authority. The state shouldn't be parenting your child. But on the flip side, they should also act according to subsidium. And subsidium is the principle that those higher, more powerful authorities should take their power and they should use it to help the lower authorities, like parents, to parent and exercise their authority in the home as best as they possibly can for the benefit of human flourishing and the flourishing of the family and, of course, as a result, the flourishing of wider society. So in actual fact, in this case, this is a very clear example of subsidium in action. Is it enforceable? I guess that's the big key question in all of this. Is it actually enforceable? Because some are claiming it's not. Well, in actual fact, yes. Age verification is a very enforceable thing, and we know that it's very effective. Remember, this is not targeting the users. I think that's the wrong way to think about it. What this is actually doing is targeting the social media corporations, and it is saying to these massive corporations, no, you can no longer have unfettered access to our homes and to our young children. You actually have to go through the government first, because this government represents the parents and the well-being of the family. And so we're going to stand there as a lion in the way of your often predatory behaviours. And I think that's the best way to think about this. And it is absolutely enforceable. Pornhub, for example, in states in America, where they have been enforcing age restrictions there and age verification laws, they have simply upped sticks in those states and withdrawn because it's such an effective tool that it destroys their business model of selling pornography to people online. If you have age verification, they just up and leave the state. So it is a very effective tool, age verification, and it creates a very important barrier that, as I said, enables families to really flourish. It protects our young people, and this is a really good thing. Now, is it possible that there will be some young people who will really be determined and they will go to extreme lengths and they will break the law and find very clever ways around it? Yeah, that's always a possibility, but they will have to go to a bit more, I guess, a few extra lengths basically to actually do that in this particular scenario. But that's always a possibility. But again, so what? because laws are not constructed according to will some people break them or not. Laws are about what goods are worth protecting and upholding and at what price. And this is a price I think that's absolutely worth paying, because the good here of the human person, particularly our children and our family life, is of such great importance for the continued existence and well-being of our society that this absolutely should be a thing. Now, remember when we had cell phones banned in schools? That's only a very recent change. And I remember before that, there were a lot of people who were not doom scrolling, but doom saying. they were talking about, oh no, this won't work, and it's a laugh, it's not enforceable. Well, guess what? It actually worked, because it turns out that, contrary to the liberal claim, which is simply not true, the majority of people do actually use the law as a guide to moral behaviour. The majority of people don't break the law. This is a liberal falsehood that has been with us for many, many decades now. Often you hear this when it comes to things like alcohol, drugs, abortion. People claim, oh, people are just going to break the law anyway. The law is irrelevant. People are just doing what they want to. That is simply not true. It's never been true. And it's based on some false mythology around the actual prohibition era during the 1920s in America, alcohol prohibition. And people wrongly believe that prohibition didn't work. Now, I think there are other reasons to oppose the banning of alcohol under general societal conditions like ours, barring some sort of extreme emergency. I actually think there are other good reasons to oppose such an action on the part of the government, and instead to adopt healthy and morally sound and appropriate restrictions around alcohol instead. But you cannot claim that prohibition didn't work in reducing alcohol consumption and negative alcohol harms. It had a massive impact, between 30 and 50%, according to the experts who have studied this, in decreasing alcohol consumption as a result of prohibition. If you had a health program that resulted in that kind of an outcome, you would say this has been hugely effective. And there were flow-on effects from this. The rate of alcohol-related admissions to hospital and alcohol-related criminality, all of that dropped away massively during this period. But despite that, people wanted to believe that it didn't work. They created false mythologies, and they also created the myth that this actually empowered and gave rise to organized crime. You often hear this claim. People will just go underground and you'll have all these illegal, dangerous operations. Well, in actual fact, organized crime was already a thing before prohibition. It didn't grow any stronger. It just found another revenue source in alcohol, and it didn't go away afterwards. It's not like it suddenly became more violent or more vociferous or anything like that. It didn't actually empower those negative forces either. It turns out, as I said, the majority of people do actually lead lives where they allow the law to be pedagogical, to be a teacher, and to teach them how to behave. As I said, we saw this just recently with cell phones in school. And so you will expect to see the same sort of thing happening when it comes to social media in the family home. And what it does is it actually now empowers parents to be able to say to young people, hey, look, I'd really love to be able to let you on Facebook, but it's a government law. All of a sudden, you get to play good cop, bad cop, and the parents are empowered. And it really does shut down the whole debate, because it's not like the children versus the parents under the old liberal regime, where they say, oh, it's all about families deciding and parents can decide for themselves. But in actual fact, what you're doing is you're setting up a dichotomy between parents and children, where the parents are now the ultimate arbiters, not the government, because there's no law banning it. And so parents are seen as the ultimate villain if they actually want to do what is wise and in the best interest of their children, say, actually, we won't have social media until we've reached 16 in this household. And all of a sudden, it becomes a massive burden on the parents and an unfair imposition, I'd suggest, to put them into that position. Far better to have the government bearing that burden and shouldering that load and allowing parents to get on with the business of forming healthy and vibrant and flourishing relationships with their children so they can help them through the important journey of life. And of course, who wouldn't want to benefit in their family life from a protective layer that protects certain ideological predators? I don't mean sexual predators or financial predators who are trying to scam your children, but I mean ideological predators who want to get quick and easy access to our children and to promote all sorts of dangerous and unhealthy and immoral ideologies to them. All of a sudden, that doorway will be shut. And that is absolutely a good and positive thing. As I said, the research indicates to us that if we could actually get our children off social media and more time in the real world with real people, then they would actually flourish more. We would start to see a diminishing in mental health rates of actual harms of mental health and depression, anxiety, and things like this. We would start to see a decrease in some of those more vociferous forms of bullying. There would be quite a radical and good change for the human flourishing of our young people and of course, as a result, our families and our wider society. So should we ban social media for children under 16? Absolutely we should. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, live by goodness, truth and beauty, not by lies. And I'll see you next time on The Dispatches. The Dispatches podcast is a production of Left Foot Media. If you enjoyed this show, then please help us to ensure that more of this great content keeps getting made by becoming a patron of our work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time on The Dispatches.